Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. The Delta smelt is not the most exciting fish in the world. About the size of a finger, silvery, a little translucent, they look a bit like sardines. Their home is the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta in Northern California, or at least it used to be. Biologist Peter Moyle has been studying Delta smelt for decades. When he started in the 70s and first asked for Delta smelt samples to be delivered to his lab, there were literally truckloads of them.
This truck pulls up in the building I had my lab and said, "Where do you want all these smelt?" And one of my great regrets is that when I was working with smelt and they were really abundant, I never ate any of them.
Peter first noticed a massive drop in their numbers in the 1980s.
The Delta is the heart of California's water system. It's literally the beating heart of California's water system.
Biologists looked for reasons why smelt populations kept shrinking. One potential culprit, freshwater being pumped away for agriculture. That made the Delta water saltier, which was not good for the smelt.
The problem is there's no smoking gun from that because every year there's also other things going on.
Delta smelt are good at dealing with all kinds of adversity. They only live for 1 year. That means an extremely cold or dry year can threaten the entire species. So the smelt improvised.
Every year, smelt were doing different things. Some would go up into the delta to spawn. Some would go elsewhere. A few fish would live for 2 years rather than just one. Each year in the estuary, some portion of that population was always doing the right thing.
This ability has protected them from nature's wrath, but it cannot save them from the changes humans have brought.
We screwed up the estuary to a point where none of those strategies would work anymore.
The Delta smelt became the face, if you will, of a big fight over water use. What would it take to save the species? But there was also another nagging question. Should we save this little fish, and why?
There has always been an appeal to beauty and wonder in the conservation movement, and there's always been some appeal to self-interest.
That's Michelle Nyehouse. Her new book is Beloved Beasts. She says when humans get involved in conservation to undo some of the damage we've done to the environment, we still apply our human lens and interests to the effort.
This is the species you love to hunt, so you should save it. Or this is a species that's part of the world we inhabit, and therefore we should keep it. We should preserve it for its own sake and also our sake, too, because we also depend on, you know, a working ecosystem.
Which creatures do we want to save? Is this about them or is this about us? On today's episode, a look at conservation and the human motivations behind it. To get started, let's stick with the Delta smelt. It's on the verge of disappearing, but scientists are making a last-ditch effort to save this fish. Jad Slaman picks things up from here.
So, Delta smelt. They're not especially cute or clever, but they do have this one weird little thing going for them.
Oh my God, they smell amazing.
That's Mandy Finger, a population geneticist at UC Davis in California.
They smell like the best version of cucumbers you could ever imagine. They smell really good.
Do we know why?
I don't know why.
No one knows why. Not for certain. I asked around.
Oh no, they smell great though. They really do. I've gotten to smell Delta smelt, you know, before they were all gone.
Every year, scientists go out in search of these guys, scouring tangles of stream and wetland. They've been finding fewer and fewer for decades, only catching a handful in the past few years. This most recent season, it looked like they weren't going to catch any until actually just before Mandy and I spoke in January. It was one single fish. The team dropped everything to get it back alive and into these tanks with other smelt that scientists are raising in captivity. It's at a place called the Davis Fish Conservation and Culture Laboratory.
There's a lot of tanks black tanks that are painted black inside with filtration systems and, you know, with shade cloth over it. So it's pretty small. Like, you would never know that that's like where all the Delta smelt in the world are.
Technically, it's half of the remaining Delta smelt. There's a backup about 300 miles north near Mount Shasta with other refugee Delta smelt in case fires or earthquake or whatever knock out Mandy's tanks. She's been working with these fish for 10 years.
I basically am a matchmaker for Delta smelt. The hatchery personnel, they put tiny tags with individual IDs into the males and the females, and I tell them specifically mate YO33 with OW67. And I do that based on relatedness. I'm trying to minimize relatedness.
Mandy is essentially trying to buy time. The idea is to eventually release these fish into the wild again. But in conservation, it's not enough, apparently, just to keep a certain number of threatened fish alive somewhere, safe and secure.
Every species is shaped by their environment. You know, you can't take the species out of the environment and expect it to stay the same species. You know, a Delta smelt in a hatchery is a hatchery smelt, not a Delta smelt.
Mandy's fish refuge was started with fish caught in the wild in 2006. And with each passing generation, born and raised in the tanks, they've started adapting to that environment. Genetically speaking, they become less and less wild. Genes that serve artificial tank living over natural delta living increasingly win out.
Well, you can slow it down, but you can't stop it.
Slowing it down used to be easier, when scientists were catching more wild delta smelt. Mandy had all these wild, young, single fish to throw into the tank mix, spread their wild genetics around. Those days are gone. Now one single wild fish is a showstopper.
But it's just like, oh my God, you know, like, one fish is not enough.
Without introducing enough wild Delta smelt, tank raised smelt will eventually become something akin to a different species. That's a problem because in conservation, species is everything. I first heard about the Delta smelt from research Mandy and others did that found that scientists were having a hard time telling the Delta smelt apart from this other fish species from Japan. They're called the Wakasagi.
You know, when you have them in your hand and they're small or they're in a bottle and they've been jostled around, it's hard to identify them.
The Wakasagi were introduced to California waters in the 50s and they proved hardier than the Delta smelt. There's no shortage of them here or in Japan. When they're young, they look basically identical to Delta smelt to the naked eye. They're so similar, in fact, to this nearly extinct fish that scientists were worried about hybridization. They were worried this plentiful fish and the Delta smelt would start hooking up, making mixed species fish babies. At some point, scientists worried Wakasagi Delta smelt hybrids would eventually become more Wakasagi than Delta smelt, and therefore no longer endangered, but also, in a way, extinct. Once a species hybridizes with another, you can't unscramble that egg. The original species is lost. Now, with the Delta smelt and the Wakasagi, this didn't end up happening. But I asked Mandy, like, why not just let it happen? Why not maybe encourage it to happen? Wouldn't some small part of the Delta smelt still live on in future Wakasagi hybrids?
Should we consider, you know, interbreeding Wakasagi and Delta smelt to make them more fit in the ecosystem? Because the ecosystem is not supporting Delta smelt. That is clear.
She says, though, that the answer for now is no. It would be like giving up on the Delta smelt to let this distinct species melt away into something else. It makes you think, though, why are we going to so much trouble to preserve so many species? To preserve this one particular cucumber-smelling, sardine-looking species, if there's another one essentially just like it?
You know, it's funny because I had a lot of conversations about this over the last few days because I knew you were going to ask about it. And first of all, I think as a society, you know, we passed the Endangered Species Act to protect species, and the Delta smelt is a species. And if it goes extinct, we've lost something that we can never recover. So it falls in line with my personal ethics that I think it deserves to exist because it does exist.
It's a beautiful sentiment. I really think that. But given how many species, like the Delta smelt, find themselves at the center of fierce debates over space, water, agriculture, or development, over the need to feed growing populations of humans, given how hard conservation is, how many species can we truly save?
Well, it's just impossible to keep things as they are. The human population of the planet is still continuing to rise.
Chris Thomas is director of the Leverhulme Center for Anthropocene Biodiversity at the University of York in the UK.
Human activities on the planet are so pervasive. The greenhouse gases, the CO2 in the atmosphere, has changed photosynthesis of every plant individual on the planet.
Thomas spent a lifetime in the field, counting this plant or that, butterfly eggs. He used to believe in the gospel of save everything, but not anymore. He gives me a few reasons.
The first is that we'll fail, and there's not much point putting all of your efforts into what you know is not going to be successful on a timescale of, let's say, the next century.
A lot of this is driven by climate change. He tells me it's possible a full three quarters of all animal species are now on the move in some fashion because of the climate. He advocates a more dynamic kind of conservation, one that deliberately picks winners or losers, which, by the way, he argues we already do, even if we don't admit it. We care about noble gray wolves and cute pandas, while countless snails and spiders so obscure as to only have Greek and Latin scientific names fade quietly into oblivion. Mandy says an animal's existence is its right to exist. Chris, he thinks that idea has more to do with us, humans, than with the animals themselves.
I think that the articulation of an intrinsic value of nature is, in a sense, I won't say it is religious, but it is akin to religious belief in the value of something, that it has some kind of independent existence that is separated from the human. And so when we value it, we are the people who are doing that valuing.
Chris respects that, but he thinks we have to be pickier. There's two emerging strategies. The first is to preserve exceptionally unique species. New Zealand's Tuatara lizard, for example, looks like any old iguana, but it's actually the last of its order, the sole heir of distinct genetics from 250 million-year-old ancestors. The other strategy involves preserving backup species, plants or animals that are important to us or larger ecosystems. If a certain utilitarian tree species goes extinct in Asia, maybe a similar enough one survives in South America. In short, Chris says we gotta start making decisions, and tough ones. There's too much at stake not to.
All future biological communities, all future ecosystems are going to be constructed from the descendants of today's species.
It's more difficult and perhaps even more hubristic in a way than the preserve everything ethos. It's like, who are we, the humans of 2021, to accurately guess what's going to be best for a future ecosystem we're not even going to be around for? Both these tests should help us decide. The uniqueness test, the backup for a useful species test. The Delta smelt, though, they fail both of these. The Delta would hardly notice if the Delta smelt completely disappeared. In a cruel natural irony, the more scarce an animal becomes, the less important it is for the function of its natural habitat. And likely, most of us on land wouldn't notice either, blissfully ignorant of a cucumbery fish we never got to smell and likely never will.
I can't tell anybody who will never, ever even know that Delta smelt existed and went extinct. And, you know, they've got their own problems that they should feel this great loss because Delta smelt are extinct now. But I know that they are going extinct. And I know better.
I guess so do I now, and so do all of you.
When I found out they hadn't caught any wild Delta smelt this year, I called my advisor and I was almost in tears. I was like, what do I do? You know? And he's like, well, some problems aren't solvable.
Mandy, of course, just kept on going to work. She emailed me in February that researchers found a second Delta smelt, a female. She matched her with an eligible bachelor just after Valentine's Day, a stubborn kind of hope.
It's the politics, and there's so many people in California. It's just such a hard battle. And, you know, you ask, like, why do we preserve this fish? And you know, sometimes you're like, I don't know. Like, it's looking pretty grim, but they're still here.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
Why are we trying to save this species? And how should we go about conservation? Those are big questions.
What conservation is really going for is protecting relationships. It's about protecting relationships among species. It's about protecting relationships between species and their habitat. And it's about protecting our relationship with other species.
That's science journalist Michelle Nyhaus. She wrote a new book about the history and future of the conservation movement. It's called Beloved Beasts. It seems like those kinds of conversations are often absent, though, from whatever battle is happening at the moment to save a species or not save a species. So it doesn't seem like we have those clarifying conversations first. Like, what is the goal here? What are we trying to accomplish? And how can we maybe get together?
Exactly. Right? Yeah. I mean, if I could tell a brief story.
Yeah, please.
I mean, in the mid-1990s, before I was a journalist, I had a job helping out on a wildlife research project in southern Utah in the desert where I would, and my job was to follow desert tortoises around and take notes on what they ate. And the desert tortoises were a threatened species. They still are. And I was so struck by the political arguments that were taking place over the tortoise and how to protect it. People were ostensibly arguing over, well, should we, you know, curtail this housing development? Should we close this off-road vehicle trail? But really, they were just having this very sort of often confused or deeper argument about, why should we protect this species at all? Why does it matter? Why does this one species matter? Those questions are so profound that those are not going to be answered in a single meeting. So often, these political conflicts over endangered species and so forth become intractable because there's no base agreement. There's no base clarification. One of the problems I see is that it's very convenient for corporations to exploit this kind of confusion and say, oh, well, you know, conservation is all about taking your job from you and you should oppose it. But the other thing I see that happening is that conservation organizations try to simplify their message down to one species. You heard about the seal growing up or the blue whale, or they use these flagship species to symbolize the greater project of conservation. You know, it's much more complicated to say, we want to protect as many species as we can, and what we really want to protect are the relationships among them for your sake and for the sake of these other species. It's much easier to put up a picture of an adorable seal and skip that complicated conversation, but I feel we need to be more forthright about what we're really trying to do, because conservationists aren't just trying to protect one species and one species habitat. They're going for something more profound, and I think that needs to be more front and center so that we can finally have those complicated conversations at a length at which we might actually be able to make some progress.
Yeah, and the emotional attachment to one animal brings all of that emotion into the conversation, but it doesn't solve the problem.
Exactly. And sometimes those divisions come up because people do get very attached to a single species.
Have you heard any successful pitches, so to speak, for the idea of talking more about habitat rather than individual species? So just talking about the space to live and what that means and how we can get involved in preserving that.
I mean, you often hear appeals to save beautiful exotic landscapes, beautiful wilderness areas from industrial development. Those are obviously very important. We need, you know, we need extensive habitats where there are very few, if any, people who are permanent residents. But we also need habitats that are perhaps not as flashy, are perhaps not as quote-unquote pristine, you know, have some human activity, but are also provide some usable habitat for other species. I would like to see more reminders that we share habitat with other species.
Even if that habitat is not, like, the beachfront with the dolphins jumping up and down. I mean,
exactly. Even if that habitat is not, you know, overflowing with iconic species or is not, you know, the calendar photo image of a world class, so to speak, habitat, take a closer look and it might be full of life.
Michelle Nyhaus is a science journalist. Her new book is Beloved Beasts. How we view certain animals and whether we want to protect them often depends on where we encounter them. In cities, wildlife tends to elicit shrieks of horror rather than cries for compassion. Xavier Lopez has this look at wildlife in the city.
Carroll Gardens in Brooklyn looks like many other East Coast city neighborhoods. Three-story brownstones, trees dotting the sidewalks, grocery stores, cafes, flower boxes, people walking their dogs, a cat in the window. But a few years ago, neighbors started to see some unexpected visitors.
I had watched two raccoons on the roof across from me at night in the winter, walking across the roof and going into one vent and then coming out the other.
Antonio Ferraro Martinelli is a longtime resident and a sort of unofficial block captain. The neighbor everybody calls with their burning questions.
I had heard my other neighbor's stories of all of the fecal matter left by raccoons on her deck. I had heard the story of her neighbor who had a wrestling match with one of the raccoons in his first floor that was under construction and the damage that the raccoons sort of left.
Antonia says one of her neighbors had an especially close encounter.
She was trapped in her kitchen and couldn't go out into her deck because there was a giant raccoon on it. I went out to my deck and sprayed her raccoon with my hose. I had my three children in my house. I had her two children in my house. And then I had the other neighbor's daughter in my house. So one of those children videotaped.
Oh.
Attack! Attack! Oh my god!
Oh my god, are you getting this, Claude? Yes.
And so she videotaped me spraying the hose at the raccoon.
Felix's yard!
It is so fat.
Raccoons in backyards. In all of her years living in Brooklyn, she had never seen anything like this. But not seeing wild animals in the city does not mean they're not there.
Some animals, they eat, sleep, and breathe city. So they were born in the city, they're gonna die in the city. They don't go anywhere else.
That's Christopher Schell. He's an urban ecologist currently at the University of Washington, Tacoma. He's an expert on raccoons and also coyotes in cities. And he's a little bit of a nerd, which I enjoyed.
Point of awesome trivia fact is, if you ever played Super Mario Bros. 3, where Mario has the what looks like a raccoon tail, it's actually not a raccoon, it's a raccoon dog, also known as a tanuki. And they look a lot like raccoons, but they're canids, not procyonids.
Christopher says part of the reason we don't see coyotes and raccoons is because they prefer it that way.
They know how to travel around people, and they know how to essentially stay in the shadows. One of the nicknames for coyotes, for instance, from indigenous tribes and stories, is they are called the ghosts of the plains, because it's like, if you see them once, good luck seeing them again.
When these species live in cities with us, they get a little creative in their efforts to avoid humans.
So we studied, for example, raccoons in Baltimore. And it turns out that the raccoons were living and moving through the sewer systems.
That's Stan Garrett. He's a professor of wildlife ecology at Ohio State University. Like Chris, he studies both raccoons and coyotes using GPS tracking and remote camera traps. Coyotes are pretty wily themselves. When they're in cities, they learn traffic patterns and how to navigate through our infrastructure. There's even videos of them looking both ways before crossing the street.
Coyotes will use the rail lines, the railroads, or either the current railroads or old railroads that go right into the city, subways. They'll use subways as a travel lane. So they'll use our bridges, and they'll use our interstates or our major expressways.
These animals are adapting and learning to live with us because there are some benefits. Here's Christopher again.
They get year-round food. So the food subsidies are just bonkers.
While the natural diet for these creatures is mostly fruits, vegetables, small rodents, and rabbits, a lot of times they end up eating human food as well.
There are costs. So yeah, they may be eating a lot of food, and the food is natural and human food subsidies, but human food is just not great. Yeah, it's not great for us, but it's definitely not good for wildlife. They're doing what they can to survive, but can we say that they're thriving when they eat mostly cheeseburgers? No. No, none of this is okay. None of this is right.
A lot of people think of animals like raccoons and coyotes in the city as nuisances. Like, call animal control, have them put down. But behind the scenes, they're doing important work.
They're providing pretty much a free ecosystem service by eating just rats generally in the city. They will eat the rodents that we think are pests.
So they are a natural form of pest control, taking out creatures that can transmit diseases to humans. Raccoons, with their more flexible diet, have also been known to eat other types of obnoxious pests.
There are videos of raccoons, for instance, in Florida, taking iguanas that are almost as big as them.
They also help disperse seeds from the fruits that they eat in our urban forests and parks. When it comes to coyotes, Christopher thinks they're even heroic in their own way.
I like to call the coyote, at least in the urban context, the hero that we need, even though for some it's not the hero that we want, just straight up Batman style.
That's because coyotes are apex predators that dare to go in cities in ways that other predators wouldn't. They live here among us, in the shadows, eating rodents and protecting us from other types of nuisances. Here's Stan.
We have found that they are also an important kind of a bioregulator for other animals like white-tailed deer, which are difficult to manage and become overabundant. And actually, they're more dangerous in the sense that people hit them with their cars and can become injured. They definitely help to control Canada goose numbers, which Canada geese, that's an animal that also becomes overabundant in urban areas and has no predators except for the coyote. So, you know, coyotes kind of help to restore some of the balance that we need in these urban ecosystems.
We tend not to think about cities as habitat, other than for us, of course. But Naima Harris says that we should, and that we should remember how important things like green spaces are, not only for us, but for the animals that share our cities with us.
If we don't have that quality habitat and wildlife are still there, what resources are they going to exploit then? Where are they going to go? Is there a higher potential that not having those green spaces actually means that now they're in your attic or they're in your backyard or they're in your basement? Does it create more opportunities for conflict because they are in the space, they're in the city, but then they don't have lots of great places to go?
Naima is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Michigan, and she's working on a new pilot program in Detroit that aims to educate people on how to be better stewards of nature in the city.
And it's called Wildlife Neighbors. And it is basically an education program in part with middle school youth from Detroit, 5th to 8th graders, and exposing them to the wildlife neighbors using remote camera traps that we put throughout the green spaces inside of parks.
Naima's project is aimed at kids because some older generations might already have preconceived notions about these animals, whether they're good or bad. But kids are more open-minded.
You can't think about necessarily protecting something or living in harmony or with some type of coexistence if you haven't developed an appreciation and a wonder, if you will, for those critters that are there.
But ultimately, these experts say that we have to rethink our role in the survival of these species in cities. From how we build roads, to where we put parks, trees, and even buildings. For The Pulse, I'm Xavier Lopez.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. coming up, when conservation efforts get entangled in a tug of war over use of land or water, there's often a quest for compromise. We'll meet a guy who says compromise doesn't work.
You know, I am very much the skunk at the lawn party. I'm the bad cop. I'm the bearer of bad tidings and reality.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com. The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about conservation and the human lens we apply to those efforts to save nature. In 2018, Ashley Ahern left her radio reporting job in Seattle and moved to a remote valley near the Canadian border in Washington state. She lives in a small cabin surrounded by sagebrush, a grayish-green shrub that thrives in dry areas. As she got to know the land better, she fell in love with a strange and beautiful bird, the greater sage grouse. The birds have spiky tail feathers, they're brown and white, and when the males try to impress females, they inflate two yellow air sacs on their chests that end up looking like huge fried eggs. Here's a great description from one of Ashley's trips to observe the grouse with a conservationist.
Anybody who's ever been to a seagull's bar will recognize this scene. Males are puffing out their chests, strutting around, trying to catch the female's eye. And this is what their pickup line sounds like.
Ashley explores the story of this funny-looking bird in her podcast series, Grouse.
So, as I settled into rural life, I got inspired. I started recording people all over the West who have a stake in this bird's future. From people in the industries working in sage grouse country.
People in my family have lost their jobs because of what we're going through today. And it's unbearable at times.
To environmentalists fighting to protect.
The birds' numbers are declining across the West, and there is a heated debate among people in sagebrush country in terms of what to do next.
I talked to ranchers who want to graze their cattle in sage grouse country.
Do you value them as much as cows?
Well, now you're talking to a rancher.
To indigenous people whose ancestors were here before any of these other voices arrived in sage grouse country.
What happens to them is what will happen to us as people. If they don't have the right kind of environment, they will disappear.
In one part of the series, Ashley digs into the issue of compromise. If the goal is to keep this bird around, can competing interests find a path forward? Is there a solution that everybody feels good about and that actually benefits the bird? Ashley picks it up from here.
So I headed to the Red Desert, about 40 miles outside of Rawlins, Wyoming, to meet someone who has been fighting to protect sage grouse for almost 20 years. And he's made some enemies in the process.
Well, I am very much the skunk at the lawn party. I'm the bad cop. I'm the bearer of bad tidings and reality.
Eric Molvar's tall, bearded, and broad-shouldered. He looks like the kind of guy you'd run into at a hunting lodge in the Alaskan bush, rather than a city environmentalist, Patagonia-wearing type, which is what I was expecting. He's a controversial figure in sagebrush country. He's the executive director of Western Watersheds Project, which is known as one of the most litigious environmental groups working in the West. I've talked to a lot of people working on the sage-grouse issue on all sides of the spectrum, from scientists and environmentalists to ranchers and oil and gas industry folks. And Eric and Western Watersheds have been described as a bit extreme and sometimes alienating in their tactics.
By using litigation and the law as our primary tool, Western Watersheds Project and the groups like us and who have been aligned with us are doing more to protect the sage-grouse than any other type of group out there.
So I was naturally curious to hear his thoughts on compromise when it comes to sage-grouse. For years, I believed that compromising is the only way to solve tough environmental problems. But Eric abandoned that notion years ago. Is he right? We camp together not far from his favorite sage-grouse lek in the Red Desert. Just miles and miles of open sagebrush all around us, dotted with a few oil pump jacks and abandoned homesteads.
All right.
And that first night we went out to the lek, which was really just a patch of open meadow in the sagebrush. There were no grouse there that evening. The birds gather first thing in the morning to do their mating dances and displays. I've never set one of these up. Are they pretty straightforward?
Well, I can do it.
Oh, okay. We set up two blinds right in the middle of the meadow area so we'd have a hiding place to watch the birds when they arrived the next morning.
Reasonably easy to set up and taking down.
Oh, sorry, thanks.
Cast iron pain in the butt.
The blinds look like little camouflage confessional booth tents, sort of. They're just big enough for an adult to sit upright and peek out through these zipper mesh windows. This would give us front row seats for the mating activity. Closer than I'd ever been to these birds before in all my recording for this podcast.
And we will get up at wee hours in the morning for the first glimmer of dawn. And we will be in these blinds and all ready to go before the sage grouse even show up. And then tomorrow morning they will come flying in. We'll be here at the lek with them, but they won't perceive us if all goes to plan.
We finished setting up and headed back to camp to have dinner and talk. The sunset over the sage was rose gold and calm, and we sat together watching it. Eric's an interesting guy, and he speaks in a direct, blunt way, not unlike the way he works on behalf of sage grouse, actually.
While everybody is having sunny platitudes and trying to escape from reality, I'm trying to make everybody face reality, and that's politically unpopular, and that's okay. Because in conservation, there's a spectrum between popularity and effectiveness. And every inch you move toward popularity means ground you have to give up from effectiveness. And every time you move toward effectiveness, you sacrifice popularity. So you have to decide, do I want to be popular or do I want to do something to help the planet? And I made my decision.
Eric's not much interested in compromise or negotiation. He says environmentalists, when it comes to issues involving big, moneyed interests like the oil and gas industry, often end up on the outside looking in. Suing is their main way to gain traction. Getting a bunch of different interests together to try to find common ground doesn't actually help the planet, from Eric's point of view. It just makes all the different parties feel good, and the sage grouse end up losing out.
And that's what you end up with in these collaborative groups, because each different interest has a little intersection where they can meet and have a compromise. And when you have five or six of these different interest groups, that area of intersection is so tiny and so irrelevant from a conservation standpoint that what you can agree on isn't even worth pursuing.
Do you think you're a fundamentalist?
I'm just a pragmatist. I've just come to this realization of what works and what doesn't. You know, if collaboration actually worked, I'd be the first one on the bandwagon.
Okay, so that's one way of looking at the role of compromise. Basically, that it's not worth wasting time or energy on it. Better to just fight it out in court. And sometimes going to court is what's necessary. Environmental groups, including Eric's, had to sue the government to get them to even consider this key question. Should sage grouse be listed under the Endangered Species Act? Now, in many parts of the rural West, the Endangered Species Act might as well be a four-letter word. It gets people really riled up, and it's become a bit of a lightning rod for tensions with the federal government. Basically, for some people out here, environmental protections and regulations mean government overreach into private property rights and individual freedoms. And if you're in the oil and gas industry, or you raise livestock in sage-grouse country, you do not want this bird listed, because it will mean a whole lot more government scrutiny of how you do business and more restrictions on how you can use public and privately owned land. So the looming threat of having the bird listed as endangered brought people to the table to hammer out a mega compromise that everyone in the sage-grouse world still talks about today. It was called the Greater Sage-Grouse Conservation Strategy. And I want to spend some time with this because it's central to answering this larger question I have about whether compromise works and is it worth it? Okay, so flashback to 2012. The Obama administration is wading into this question of whether the sage-grouse should be listed as endangered or not. And Jim Lyons is one of three key senior staffers at the Department of Interior tasked with figuring that out.
Unfortunately, the secretary referred to us in a speech one day as the three grouseketeers, which I hesitate to even repeat on this recording, but it reflects how much time we spent working on this issue.
Jim and his team worked with the governors and wildlife managers of 11 western states, as well as the Federal Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And over the next 2 years, they met regularly and wrestled with all the different competing interests in sagebrush country. The oil and gas industry pushed state leaders to give them more land for drilling. The livestock industry wanted more land for grazing. Environmentalists like Eric wanted stronger protections for the bird. And sometimes all those interests were in conflict. But after months of hard conversations,
I think we did reach agreement.
Jim said they were able to develop plans, state by state, that balanced sage-grouse habitat needs with human interests. And ultimately, prevented the bird from being listed under the Endangered Species Act.
Much of it was controversial, but we worked together, worked hard to get there. But then there were some elements that the states didn't like.
The plans limited mining, drilling, and grazing in some key areas for grouse. And the industries in several states made it clear they weren't pleased with those restrictions. Idaho sued the Department of the Interior. But they weren't the only ones who were unhappy. Eric Molvar with Western Watersheds Project and other conservation groups also sued, saying the plans didn't do enough to protect sage-grouse. Scientists like Matt Holleran, who studies how oil and gas affects sage-grouse, also had some concerns about the plans.
As scientists, we pointed out to the administration, okay, this is where we deviate from the science, and we feel that you should be stronger here and stronger here and stronger here. But we also recognize that there do have to be compromises, because otherwise you won't get anything done.
Maybe that's the sign of a good compromise, right? No one gets everything they want, and everyone comes away less than satisfied. Matt acknowledged that sometimes in a negotiation, you don't get everything you want up front. But he took solace in a key part of the plans. They called for follow-up.
Yeah, every 5 years, we're checking back.
Right.
And there's all these programs that were set up in those 2015 plans. I mean, it's right there.
Programs designed to monitor progress. You know, see how the plan is working. Great in theory, right?
But what's really disappointing is from what I see, is the not following through on that assessment aspect of the 2015 plans.
I asked Jim Lyons about that. Why hadn't the 2015 plans he helped develop stuck? I guess what happens is it shakes my confidence in the role of compromise, because it seems like you hammered out this amazing compromise, but it didn't have anything to force the follow-up so that it was immune to a subsequent administration or state activity that might try to unravel it.
Well, I agree, and I'm concerned about that too, but, you know, compromise relies on the goodwill of all parties to follow through. And we're not seeing goodwill on the part of all parties in moving forward. And I don't know, you know, how you backstop that. It leads to regulation. It leads to litigation.
Since 2015, when the plans Jim Lyons and the Obama administration developed were finalized, sage-grouse populations have declined by 44% on average across the West. I'll say that again. There are 44% fewer sage-grouse in the West than there were when the Great Sage-Grouse Compromise was finalized in 2015. So I keep returning to this question. Is compromise going to keep sage-grouse around? And that brings us back to Eric Molvar with Western Watersheds Project.
There's a spot.
He traded in compromise for legal action a long time ago. It's still dark and below freezing when Eric parks about 200 yards from the lek, and we walk through the sagebrush as quietly as we can and zip ourselves into our blinds. We can only whisper from here on out so we don't disturb the birds. Eric is in the blind next to me, talking into a wireless microphone, so I can hear him, but he can't hear or see me.
It's full dark. And the frost is sparkling in the moonlight. aggressor, competitor. And when they inflate their chest sacs, bright yellow sacs of skin can be seen.
Eric and I zipped ourselves into our respective blinds. I gave him a list of questions. The last one was, what do you wish your opponents understood about you?
The one thing that I wish the opponents of conservation, the industries that are destroying sage-grouse habitat, threatening the natural values of the West, would understand about me. The battle doesn't go to the swift or the strong. The battle doesn't go to the one with the most money. The battle goes to the last one standing on the battlefield. And I plan to outlast them all. For those industries bent on destroying Western public lands for their own profits, I'm watching.
That was an excerpt from the podcast series Grouse, created and hosted by Ashley Ahern and edited by Whitney Henry Lester. Sound design by Liza Yeager. Grouse was produced in collaboration with Boise State Public Radio and BirdNote. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And here's another reason to check it out. Starting next week, we're going to release podcast extras, for example, conversations with scientists who are doing great work.
So you got some birds out there that, you know, produce one learned simple song, like a just like mm-hmm. that, right? And that's my song sparrow whistle. Then you have some other birds that can go. They're both vocal learners, but one's more advanced than the other.
What can bird whistles teach us about the ability to learn language? Why can some birds talk?
Nice to see you.
But dogs can't.
Speak.
Make sure you subscribe so you won't miss it. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Sojourner Ahebe is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.